Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books and Fantasy, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. This is your host, Gabrielle Matthew. Today, we'll be talking to Rin Chepeco about their multicultural YA fantasy, Wicked As You Wish, which is the first in the new series. Wicked As You Wish begins with our Filipina narrator, Tala, and her best friend, Alexei. They both attend high school in a small Arizona town of Invierno. Alexa has a few secrets. For one, he's gay, but not out. And for another, he's the exiled Prince of Avalon, hiding from the evil Snow Queen and her minions, which include the ICE, the U.S. Immigration Department. Want can't hide from the Snow Queen forever, though. Soon there are scary ice maidens roaming the halls of the local high school, hunting Alexei. Tala's family, the Makilings, along with her tias and titos, fight to protect Alexei, but have a hard time against enemies that also include ogres and the undead. Luckily, reinforcements arrive when the Bandersnatchers, a group of teen magicians dedicated to Avalon, show up armed with various cool weapons and quips, and the adventure is just beginning. This mashup offers a mix of everyone's favorite fairy tales. Hi, I've got Rin Chepeco to talk about their new series, Wicked As You Wish, is the first book in that series. Are you with us?
Oh, yes. Hi. Thank you for having me.
Hi, Rin and I have quite a lot of miles to cover in our phone call, but I've been able to get hold of them. So I'm going to start off with the questions. The narrator of the book, Tala, has been living in a dull Arizona town where magic doesn't work. When her best friend, the exiled Prince Alexei, has to flee for his life, she joins up with a group of teens with special supernatural abilities. They're called the Banders, which is short for their full title. They're members of the Order of the Bandersnatch. Can you introduce them quickly and tell us a little about the amazing weapons that they possess?
Well, okay. So first of all, I really wanted this sort of eclectic band of like rabble rousers and merry men, women, and non-binaries, because I wanted to showcase the sort of people that I've met in my life, people that I love, people that I respect and that I like, and I sort of put a lot of their personalities in each and every one of them. So to start with Tala, in a book that's mainly full of magic, I wanted her to stand out. So the easiest way to stand out was to make her the anti-magic person in the group, which means she basically negates magic. And in Philippine culture, there is this sort of powerful object, magical object called the agimat. And that basically... An agimat basically prevents anyone from cursing you or casting spells on you. So I sort of incorporated that idea into her powers, also as a showcase for her Filipino culture and our history as superstitious people who still believes in magic. And with Alexei, he technically doesn't have like a magic sword of his own, but he does have the Firebird, which is in itself sort of like a character of its own. And the Firebird, I've actually based more of my personality into the Firebird, who is very sassy and kind of an asshole in a lot of ways. So when people usually ask me, like, which character in this book is the one that's most closely like you, and I will usually say the Firebird, and I like seeing their face when I say that. And basically, the Firebird is basically flame based. It's constructed of fire, and he sort of provides Alex with his defense, because for the most part, he's pretty defenseless. And when the Firebird arrives, he becomes Alex. Well, Alex tends to rely on him for his sort of magic and, yeah, for his protection. And after that, we have Zoe, who has this whip called the Ognios, and it basically sends out electricity through like the lash. And then there's Cole, who has this sword called the Gravekeeper, and he basically his sword is actually based on a fairy tale called The Companion by, I think it was Hans Christian Andersen, but it's very underrated, I think, and not a lot of people actually know it. So it's very much based on that fairy tale. And what he does is he can actually take the minions of the Snow Queen, who is the villain in the story, and he sort of mind controls her shadow minions and is able to turn them against her, which I think was a pretty sort of a bit of a game changer that I wanted to add to the story. Then we have Loki, who has the Jing Ring Bang, which is a Chinese staff. If people are familiar with Journey to the West, this Chinese legend, the staff actually plays a very important part in there, in the story, which was wielded by Son Goku, or the Monkey King. The name of the Chinese sort of monkey-like character in that is called Sun Wukong.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have West, who is basically the shapeshifter who can transform into different kinds of animals, which I sort of tried to use it as a homage to the Aesop's fables, where most of the characters are actually animals. So that's how I wanted to play it. And then we have Ken, who is basically wielding two legendary swords. They're also in Japanese mythology. He basically wields two legendary swords forged by these legendary Japanese swordsmen in Japanese history. And one can basically cut through anything that isn't alive, and the other one pretty much turns people insane if they use it for evil. So rounding it all up, basically the cast of characters that you will meet in the story, the start of the story at least.
And they're crazy weapons. Well, back to the narrator, Tala. She uses the Filipino martial art Arnis, and we've talked about how she can block spells. But compared with all those colorful characters like Wes, who's constantly changing into a rat or a bear, or Cole, whose disguise is made out of ogre blood, Tala seems a little low-key. So does she have a special destiny that's going to be revealed?
Well, that is very much in spoiler territory, but
you could hint
if you want. apart of the legend of, well, basically my story is about this kingdom of Avalon who has been destroyed by the Snow Queen, and Alex, who was the prince of that kingdom, has been forced into hiding just so the Snow Queen doesn't find him, and so that she doesn't find the Firebird, which he believes is the key to a lot of the magic in his kingdom. So that has been his whole life, trying to stay alive long enough to find the Firebird on his own. And I like, in a lot of ways, when you talk about Tala and when you talk about being Filipino, a lot of Filipinos don't actually want to stand out. Like, it might be, you know, because we're Asian and that's sort of the culture that we grew up with, but we tend to just put our heads down and try to go about our day, do the things that we like without necessarily standing out. Because we get, there's a sort of embarrassment when it comes to people looking at us and trying to, you know, it's not really Asian culture to be standing out anyway. So, I mean, with that in mind, Tala's sort of magic, when it comes to, I mean, in a world full of magic, being able to negate magic sort of stands out because you can get in trouble for it. And that's what she's been trying to do. Her attitude, her whole life has been, put your head down, keep out of trouble, don't tell anyone about what you can do, because if people find out what you can do, you could, I mean, things could get worse for you. So that the whole magic of her with the agimat is basically my way of sort of showcasing Filipino personalities as well. Like, this is what we do. Like, we do our best, but we don't want to stand out. We try to do what we think is the best thing for us and the best thing for other people, because we're very community oriented as well. But in the end, it's not necessarily something that, you know, we don't want to be leaders. We just want to have our own little corner of the world and live well within it. So that's her attitude, and that's how it reflects in her magic.
So we talked about Tala being part of being Filipino and Filipino people being very community-minded. So there's actually not just Tala's family, but another Filipino community in the neighborhood that's dedicated to protecting Prince Alex until he can save his country of Avalon. So tell us a bit about the, I hope I say this right, Katipuneros, and
yes,
what
the
they use to fight. How do they fight?
Okay, well, here's another thing about Filipinos. Like, we are like a nation of immigrants, because, you know, in the Philippines, there's not a lot of jobs to go around, and what jobs there are aren't always enough to pay the bills and support family. So we're sort of became known for like going out to other countries and then working there and then sending as much money as we can back home. And in order to do that, like to be strangers in a very strange place, we got very, very good at finding other Filipinos within the community. Because once Filipinos find out, hey, you just moved here, you're living in my area, hey, come on over, we'll do our best to help you out. So that's sort of the Filipino way. It's called bayanihan. That sort of culture where you help each other rise up, like pull a fellow Filipino up the ladder with you. That's sort of a very, very cultural thing with us. And when it comes to the Katipuneros, actually, I base that on historical heroes. In Filipino history, there is this revolutionary group called the Katipuneros, and they were actually the ones who first rose and tried to push back against the Spaniards, who were colonizing the Philippines for close to over 300 years. And then after them, the American forces who came over here and tried to do the same. And that was sort of that sort of resistance I had in mind when I was trying to come up with a group of Filipinos who were also trying to be the modern resistance. And Katipuneros were the first thing that I thought about, who very, very closely aligns with, you know, Lola Urduja and her band of merry men and women. And they share the same goals as those historical figures. So I thought, why not, you know, do homage to them and name them Katipuneros as well. So basically, they share the same goals, the historical idea of Katipuneros and the Katipuneros as I wrote them in the book, in that Filipinos look out for each other within a community. That's the Filipino way. So once they know, hey, we know you're Filipino, we know you're having a hard time, we're going to do all we can to help you. And it doesn't always just apply to Filipinos. Like, if we consider you a friend, we welcome you to the fold, you're like an honorary Filipino, and that's exactly what they did with Alex. So, you know, they sort of took him under his wing, and they're like, okay, we're going to feed you, we're going to mother you, we're going to protect you, and you're going to be the family that you never had. And again, that's a very Filipino thing to do.
So the Katipuneros, they're the tios and titos. They seem elderly. They fight with fans, by the way, for those of you who are wondering. And so we've got people who are presumably rather old, and then we've got very young people, and they're the ones taking the most active roles. Did you purposely set out to develop that when you were writing?
I think that was more fleshed out when I went into edit of the book. Because when I started fleshing out the story, I was actually a teen. Like, it was in no shape for me to write yet, but the ideas of it were already there, and I was sort of coming up with characters, I was coming up with settings, but the story wasn't fully fleshed out until I really started devoting more time to actually writing and trying to publish this book. This was actually the first book that I've ever completed.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, when you first start, you want the teens to be the heroes, because when I started writing that, I was a young adult as well. But by the time I started, you know, putting the finishing as on it, I am closer to my mom's age than I ever was to being that teenager when I first started out. So, and you know, I guess that's sort of reflected in the final draft of the story, where I think, you know, I know that young adult books are all about, hey, teenagers saving the world, the adults are useless, it's always up to the teens, and I sort of wanted to push back against that, also being as a, you know, someone who is also a parent themselves, that it can't always fall on the teens. There should be some accountability, there should be some responsibility when it comes to the adults as well, and that's not usually shown in a lot of YA books. I figured that I think this would be a really good opportunity to showcase how adults can still be an integral part of the story, even when the teenagers remain in the limelight.
Yeah, I think you did that, definitely. And Tala's parents are also part of the story. I just didn't have room to get into that with the questions, but her mother and father definitely continue to have an influence throughout the book. They don't just disappear off the stage like in a lot of YA books. So you have...
it's, you know, Filipino family, again, like everybody meddles in everybody's business. Once they consider your family, you are also susceptible to their meddling and their good intentions, no matter how badly it might turn out for you. Because again, everybody's concerned, everybody's worried, and that's how they show their love. They show their love through food. Filipinos show their love through food and being very nosy.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, three characters that aren't heterosexual, and each of them has dealt, or in the case of one person, probably not dealt, with their sexuality in different ways. There is a big difference, though not phonetically, interestingly enough, between Loki, who's non-binary, and then Lockley, Zoe's fiancé, who I would assume is in denial. What could explain that difference? I have some idea myself, but I want to hear your ideas since you created them.
Well, when it came to Loki, it came, both of them, for the most part, I felt it was very natural for me to add them that way, because with Loki in particular, they're also non-binary and I am also non-binary. So they were actually the first person that I've tried to write as a non-binary character, if fully on the page, like written specifically on the page that they're a non-binary character. And to do that, I had to sort of look inside myself and try to figure out what are the little subtle things that make somebody non-binary and what can I do to make them more apparent on the page. And that's what I did. It was really something that I thought too much about. It was just something that when I was writing Loki, I would just think, well, what would I do in their place? How would I react in their place? What kind of personality would they have that sort of closely aligns to what I would also do? And then I just put that down naturally. And with Loxley in particular, Tristan Loxley at this point isn't very sort of integral to the story, because you don't actually meet him in the first book, or you will be meeting him in succeeding books, because he's there to stir up trouble between Zoe and Alex, who is also gay. With Tristan Loxley, actually, there's this sort of hint that he's not actually out yet. And so what I, that was the thing that I used in my own personal life as well. Like this fear of coming out and not really sure how they would be treated once they are out in public. Like in the Philippines, like I said, we're a big community. We're very happy, but we're not always kind to gay people here in the Philippines, in that we don't even have any laws that would help support gay people here. Although we sort of give out that we're culturally accepting of gay people, but we're not actually proving it on paper in any laws or in any regulations here, which kind of sucks. And there's also that fear of, you know, Filipino families, Filipino parents want kids. They want, you know, grandkids, people to, like little kids that they can play with. And when you're gay, that's sort of that deal breaker where they're not really angry at you because of your lifestyle, but they're angry at you because you can't or won't supply them with grandkids, which is a very painful sort of issue sometimes among Filipino families who want big families and, you know, as many grandkids as you can possibly provide them. So that sort of idea of him being implied as not yet out, that was the thing that I sort of took to heart and tried to integrate into the book. And in book two and book three, you're going to see him sort of struggle with that and try to come to terms with that and try to decide which is more important. His parents who have so much expectation from him, or what he actually wants to do in life, who he wants to choose to be with. And yeah, it's an issue I feel very closely for.
Well, exactly. Loki was brought up by two men, so I assume they didn't have any problem with them being non-binary because they themselves were not in traditional sexual roles. But Loxley's parents have a lot of expectations of him, as you pointed out. So that's also what I thought when I was reading it. So Prince Alex.
I mean, it's a nice contrast. Mm-hmm. It's a nice contrast between somebody who was brought up and accepted for who they were and someone who might not necessarily be.
Exactly. And Loki always
might not enjoy the same thing. Yes.
Loki always speaks very lovingly of his father's, and they seem to have taught him many things, many practical skills as well. So Prince Alex, he is grumpy, maybe because he's missing Loxley. And sometimes he's very haughty, though to be fair, he's under a lot of pressure. However, so far, he doesn't seem wicked. So can you shed some light on the inscription, which is on your book? First, do no harm. King though you may be, thy divine right to magic is no cause to be as wicked as you wish.
Oh, okay. Well, when I wrote that inscription, it wasn't necessarily because I wanted to sermon the current king over, hey, you've done bad things in the past, that's why here is your warning not to be as wicked as you wish. But it was more of a warning to them that you understand that you have this responsibility, you have this power over magic, you have power over this spell tech that not a lot of people have access to. And you've seen for yourself what it can do to the world. Like in Alex's case, it destroyed his kingdom because the Snow Queen was responsible for the actual destruction of the kingdom. But what actually might be just as worse was the other kingdoms and the other countries sort of turning a blind eye to what the Snow Queen was doing, mm-hmm. and basically leaving them defenseless and leaving Alex alone with no support. And the reason was because a lot of those kingdoms and a lot of those countries wanted Avalon's spell tech. And with Avalon gone, they're free not to, you know, they're free to ignore any patents and just grab those technology for themselves, which is why magic had been flourishing over the last few years while Avalon was covered in ice. So that was the sort that's also a huge reason why Alex grew up being shunted from place to place, being hidden and then spirited away to somewhere new so that nobody would catch him. And he grew up that way, and he grew up very sort of bitter about seeing what everyone, like that every country saw what was happening to his kingdom, and none of them gave a crap about it. So that explains a lot about his attitude and his sort of pessimism when it comes to thinking whether or not anybody was going to help him anyway, which is why he very much latched on to Tala and her family and the other Katipuneros, because for the first time in his life, he felt like he was actually being treated as a person and not as a simp or as a figurehead of a dead country.
So you mentioned the Snow Queen and what she did to Avalon, and how Prince Alex felt like he didn't get much support from other countries. They all turned a blind eye to the Snow Queen. She seems to be adept at pulling creatures into her orbit. Several people close to Tala turn out to either be or have been in the Queen's inner circle. We won't say who. And there's also a surprise traitor at the end. So what is the appeal of the Snow Queen? What does she do to get people over to her side?
I think it's not that, we're always used to villains just for the sake of being villains. Villain caricatures where they're just evil for the sake of being evil. And sometimes that works in the story. But I also wanted to work a lot more layers when it came to the Snow Queen, in that she's not necessarily evil because it's in her nature to, but because she was evil due to some things that have happened in her life. And in many ways, her actual past sort of reflects Alex. When she was younger and when she was more vulnerable, she suffered through the same thing where nobody gave a crap about her. And so she was forced to become bitter. She was forced to grow up cold and sort of use magic that she did have to seize more power, to get more influence, just so she couldn't be hurt again. And I don't want to spoil it a little too much, but she does have history with one of Tala's family, and that sort of also motivates her sort of revenge. We used to be allies, we used to be close, so why are you now working for the enemy against me? So there's a lot of that interplay between relationship involved in a lot of the cast. And I didn't want her to be like a two-dimensional villain. I wanted some kind of sympathy for her, even if you don't necessarily agree with what she's doing. She's done unforgivable things, but in a way you sort of understand why she's doing it, even though you think you wouldn't be doing that if you're in her shoes. So that whole complicated, is she really a villain, or is she also like a victim of her own circumstances?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm sure we'll be seeing more of her in the other books as well. So your novel, you talked about different things that inspired you, like the history of the Philippines and the Katipuneros. There are actually many diverse elements. To me, it was a little bit of a mashup done by a professional writer. We've got the Snow Queen, sounds like the Chronicles of Narnia. Then we have Avalon, the Knights of the Round Table, Alice in Wonderland. And that's just a few of the many, many different elements. Would it be fair to say you write very good fan fiction?
I'd like to quote Bane paraphrase Bane from Batman a little bit with this one. Like, mm. is Is fan fiction your ally? I was born in it, molded by it. I never saw heterosexual canon until I was a young adult. And by then, I was writing AU coffee shops and / fan fiction. So, yes, like I sort of formulated the very beginnings of Wicked As You Wish when I was at the peak of my fan fiction writing. Like, I'm not going to tell anybody what my username was back in, you know, fanfiction.net and also Archive of Our Own, because I think I tried my best to wipe out all the accounts that I had there. But I'd like to think that I was pretty popular because I've been, you know, the little adrenaline boosts when you get when you're writing something that you really love, like fandoms that you really love, and the little serotonin boosts as well when you win like little awards by people who sort of aggregate certain fandoms, and you think, hey, maybe one day I could actually turn this into something that I could make a living out of. And it's not a coincidence that when I started writing Wicked As You Wish, it was also when I was so engrossed with fan fiction as well. Like the possibilities of, you know, taking characters that you love and sort of molding them into how you hope the canon should have been or canon that you wanted it to be.
You evolved them further because you don't want to let go of them, so they're like your friends. So take heart, yeah, like, fan fiction writers.
Or I don't want this ending. Let me write something that I think is better. I learned a lot of character crafting that way, and I guess the whole cast of Wicked As You Wish was the result of that.
Well, what are you working on now? Are you working on a follow-up novel?
Well, I've actually finished a draft of Wicked As You Wish 3, which is the final book in the series.
Oh, okay.
Wicked As You Wish 2 has already been turned over to my editor, and, you know, barring a few more edits, but a little bit more proofreading, it should be ready by next year. I think the target date was May 2022. And also, I started jumping out of the YA market and started writing for the adult market because also in 2022, in September, fall at least, I'm not sure if it's September, I will be releasing a sort of gothic vampire fantasy series that sort of, I like to call it Gay Castlevania.
Okay.
And it's basically for, it's not YA anymore. I hope nobody markets it or calls it YA because of the themes within it.
So you have some sex in it and adult stuff.
Basically, every time someone asks me what the summary of it is, I basically just say a vampire couple finds a vampire hunter in the trash and takes him in. That is the whole gist of, and they fight, you know, they fight bad vampires along the way. So that's basically how it goes. Again, it's a very archive of AO3 like category or trope, and I like it that way. It was supposed to be 2023. Like it was supposed to be released spring 2023, but because of a lot of printing issues, like there's a paper shortage, I think, and they were able to move it a little bit earlier. So instead of spring 2023, it's going to be fall 2022.
Well, how do people keep up with you to find out your new releases and just what you're up to otherwise and your thoughts on things? What's the best way to find you?
I actually have like a contact form on my webpage, and I always encourage people to, you know, if you have any questions about publishing or writing in general, because I know I'm a bit of an oddball being like living in the Philippines and for some reason being able to be published in the United States. And a lot of people have questions who are you know, not necessarily American citizens as well, but wanted to know how I was able to do that. I get a lot of emails every day about that. So I have a contact form in my webpage, but otherwise I am on Instagram and I am on TikTok. And,
so your webpage
I have a Facebook page.
Your webpage is Rinchupeco?
I have a Facebook page. Yes, Rinchupeco.com.
Okay.
And I have... I think I have a Facebook page, but a friend is actually running it because I don't have a Facebook account of my own. But if you have any questions there, feel free to ask, and she'll like port them over my way.
Okay, so you guys heard Rin. They're happy to help you in the Filipino tradition of taking someone else up along the way. But don't write them 100 questions, just one or two. So thanks so much for taking time out for us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Thanks for listening to me today on the New Books Network in Fantasy. I've been talking to Rinchupeco about their new novel, Wicked as You Wish. Join me in January when I interview Malaysian author Su Lin Tan about her debut novel, Daughter of the Moon Goddess, which was inspired by Asian mythology. I'm your host, Gabrielle Matthew. You can also follow me on Twitter to get updates about new podcasts and more, @GabrielleAuthor.